Welcome to Break the Chains, America's top radio source of information for people struggling with drug or alcohol addiction and those who love them. And now, the host of Break the Chains, Gwen Cardin.
Gymnast Joe Putignano was on his way to Olympic glory when, for a decade, his weakness for drugs took him down the darkest of dark paths into the depths of hell. In a matter of a few years, he went from a driven but depressed young teenage boy to a mere shadow of himself. Joe tempted death repeatedly with reckless behavior and total disregard for his life or for the feelings of those who cared for him. Even as he somehow managed to bounce back time and again after living in a homeless shelter, nearly dying, and eventually getting himself together enough to be cast in a Broadway show, he continued to stick needles into his battered body. After attaining sobriety, Joe went on to become Cirque du Soleil's crystal man in the Las Vegas show Totem. No one, least of all Joe, can explain how he is alive today, 7 years after getting clean. Now Joe has chronicled his astounding life in his new book, Acrobatic. Joe is here to talk to us about it, and I can't wait, because his is one of the most compelling, riveting books I have ever read. It was hard to put down, but at times I would have to put it down because it was so intense, but then I would have to pick it back up because I wanted to know what was going to happen next, and it was a real roller coaster read. So welcome to the show, Joe.
Thank you, Gwen. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm delighted. Joe, let's start by talking a little bit about your early life as a child before illicit drugs came into it. How did you discover gymnastics?
I was watching the 1984 Olympics, and I believe it was Mary Lou Retton or Bart Connor, one of them. And it was at one time in my life where I truly believed God came into the room and said, "This is what you're going to do for the rest of your life." And I immediately pulled the cushions off the couch, and I was trying to flip, like, and mimic exactly what I saw on television. And my brothers and sisters, they're older than me, and, you know, they were like, "You're going to hurt yourself, stop." But it was interesting because I couldn't stop. I knew it somewhere inside me that this is what I was going to do. And at first, I wasn't very good at it, and I did fall many times, but I kept trying it, and I got better and better and better, and it was really interesting because when I did something that I didn't think I could do, like a backflip or something, it filled me with this euphoric sense of accomplishment, and then I wanted more of it, more of it, and that started off on my deep passion and love for gymnastics.
Mm-hmm. And you became you began competing and doing pretty well in competitions as a child, didn't you?
Yes, it all happened very quickly. So it was interesting because it's kind of all I knew. At a very early age, well, I'd say like 8 or 9, once I showed my parents, you know, they couldn't believe it. You know, they owned a restaurant. They didn't get home till very late at night. I remember waiting up for them. You know, it was 2 o'clock in the morning to show them what I could do. And the next day, they put me in gymnastics class. And then that week, I was put on the pre-team. And then I did well there and immediately started competing. And it changed my entire life from the beginning, because my childhood wasn't like those who I knew of other kids at school. You know, they always talked about sitcoms they saw or video games they were playing. But what I knew was to go to school, come home, and go to gymnastics. And I did start to compete very early. I loved it. I mean, I didn't like competing so much, but I did love practicing because of that sense of freedom that most people find within athletics. And then when I was 11 years old, I went to the Olympic Training Center. And that was the time I knew that I was doing pretty good in the sport. You know, it was like I may have a future in this, a big future if I continue on this path. And I did return again to the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs when I was 13.
So you had dreams of being in the Olympics, and you also had a good chance of being in the Olympics with your gifts and your talents.
Yeah, I would say athletics, again, is very difficult to judge because it takes an entire lifetime to get to this one position, which for a gymnast is the Olympics. That's the greatest achievement. And injuries can happen, all this stuff. And early on for me, I did have an enormous roadblock, a terrible, terrible asthma. And it's weird because, it was very seasonal for me. I don't know if anybody out there is suffering with asthma, but definitely around the fall, and I'm from the East Coast, so when the trees would start to die, I couldn't breathe, and my parents thought it was stress. And stress may have contributed to my asthma, but it was ending me up in the hospital, not just for an emergency room visit, but for long periods of time. And as a gymnast, you can't really take time off. Not only, you know, laying in a hospital bed, but they were putting me on prednisone, which is a steroid, which kind of bloats the body. It's actually a really useful medication, but it's really terrible on the body. So I would get out of shape so quickly. I remember every time I left the hospital, I go back to the gym, and I would literally have to fight to get back in shape. But I was determined, but I had done it so many times, it became normal. You know, breathing in athletics is primary. I mean, you have to breathe. So to have my lungs not working properly was an extremely challenging thing to go through to try and, you know.
It's interesting, though, that early experience with having your body be in bad shape and fighting its way back kind of became a pattern, which we'll talk about a little bit later on. But it was kind of even teaching you at a very early age that the body can come back eventually, but it does, of course, always have its limits. What was going on, though, within your home? Because that's really a crucial part of the story that's going to unravel during the course of the hour. In addition to all the practicing and the successes you were having, the illness you were fighting, what else was happening in your family that maybe was a little bit of a challenge for you?
Yeah, my parents owned a restaurant, a seafood bar, actually, outside of Boston. And because they owned it, they had to be there all the time. And my sister was the bartender, my brother was the chef, my other older sister was a cocktail waitress. So all my adult interaction was around alcohol. And after gymnastics class, I would sit at the bar and do my homework at a very, very early age because it was rush hour. My class would get out at 8:30, and the restaurant was jam-packed, so my mom couldn't bring me home. So I would sit there at the bar and, you know, I liked it at when I was younger because I felt like a celebrity. The customers knew me. But at the older I got, the more I could see how bad alcohol was. And as this was happening, my parents started to drink a lot. You know, they started to participate in their own restaurant, and they had very, very bad drinking problems. I didn't notice this until a little bit later, until I noticed that everything was evolving around alcohol. And it made me hate it. I swore to myself I would never drink. My mom, you know, she had DUIs. I believe my dad did as well, but I'm not positive. My brother, at 17 years old, got in a horrible drunk driving accident where he had to have the jaws of life get him out. He was in an intensive care unit. They had to reconstruct his face because of the accident. So all these terrible things were happening around alcohol. The parties, the restaurant, alcohol, you know, moved back into the home. And there was parties all the time, which meant there was police. And I hated it. I mean, I just wanted... It's very difficult, and I'm sure anybody who is listening, who has parents who are alcoholics, you know, I'm not saying my parents didn't love me, because alcoholism is the kind of disease that people who have it, they don't know they have it. So my parents did love me, but when they're drunk and they're giving you this love, it's very confusing as a child because the concept of love is off a bit. So you start to disbelieve the people around you. It's like when they were so moody, you didn't know if they were going to wake up hungover or angry or confused. And, you know, the alcoholism definitely broke my family. And by the time I was, think I was 13, my brothers and sisters had moved out and my father separated. So I lived alone with my mom and I watched her really drink excessively to kind of fill the broken pieces of her heart. She was still in love with my dad. And it was very confusing because they both worked in the same restaurant. Mm. So when I was doing my homework, I would see my father at one end of the bar, my mother at the other end of the bar. And you know, he was focused on his drink and my mother was focused on him. And my mother and I never spoke about this, but we knew. I mean, she knew I knew, but I couldn't ask because It would have opened up a wound that, as a child, I don't think she wanted to put upon me.
So you have the alcoholism in your home, and you have the tremendous successes in your gymnastics, but also your social life was hard for you because, from what I read in your book, you just didn't feel that you fit in. Was that also in this mix that was going to ultimately have a bad outcome?
Yeah, I didn't. Being an athlete, all my time was focused on gymnastics, so I didn't have the same relationships with kids at school. And I definitely felt like an outsider, like an alien. It's funny, gymnastics isn't popular sport. It's very difficult, but I was teased endlessly for it, which was interesting because I could do more than the other kids. Like, if football and soccer were popular, but I was excelling at my sport on an individual level. But when I would go to school, I wouldn't get the same kind of recognition. Instead, I got made fun of, and this definitely isolated me. It broke me. And then when I would go home with this emotion, you know, to kind of seek like parental advice or care, I was getting that alcoholism instead. So my only solution, it was to go to gymnastics, which definitely became kind of, I like to call it my church, even though I'm not very religious, because it was a safe place where I felt like I was doing what I was intended to do. And that was really my only, like, salvation I had at the time.
Right, because socially at school you were not accepted. I believe you were short statured, and the asthma had affected your voice in such a way that it wasn't as deep as, you know, as the boys' voices deepened, yours did not. The kids had no appreciation for the fact that gymnastics takes even more strength and skill than any jock on the field would ever be exhibiting. And so you really gymnastics grounded you to, in a way that nothing else seemed to be grounding you. Is that correct?
Yes. I was definitely the shortest one in the class with a very squeaky voice. And, yeah, it was difficult. I know most people in retrospect look back at their childhood and can say, oh, it was a difficult childhood, which is great because it teaches us many things on a spiritual level. But as we go through it, we can kind of see the difficulties we had allowed us to create coping mechanisms later on in life, which as an adult we tend to suffer from. Mm-hmm. And in my case, this is definitely what happened. And, you know, I like to say I don't blame anybody for what I did because I made the choices. But there are contributions in our life which teach us coping mechanisms, and not every coping mechanism is a positive one.
Right, so, exactly.
Yeah, it was a perfect storm for me.
Mm-hmm, it sure was. Well, listen, it's time to take a short break, but stay tuned. We'll be right back with more interesting conversation with author and gymnast Joe Putignano.
If you're an adult suffering from drug or alcohol addiction, why not make today the day that you break the chains? At New Life Addiction Treatment Center in Port St. Lucie, Florida, we know it's not easy to pick up the phone and make that call. But remember, the caring staff at New Life is here to help. Count on us to partner with you to guide you towards getting your life back. Our confidential residential program takes most insurance plans and is designed to help meet your unique needs. Write this number down and give New Life Addiction Treatment Center a call right now. The toll-free number is 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844, the number 2, BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. Your life is waiting for you, and so are we. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or getsobernow.net. It's not easy to pick up the phone and make that call, but remember, the caring staff at New Life is here to help. Count on us to partner with you to guide you towards getting your life back. Our confidential residential program takes most insurance plans and is designed to help meet your unique needs. Write this number down and give New Life Addiction Treatment Center a call right now. The toll-free number is 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844, the number 2, BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. Your life is waiting for you, and so are we. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or getsobernow.net.
Is there someone you love who is suffering from alcohol or drug addiction? Do you feel like you simply don't know where to turn? We at Addiction Recovery Helpline know how painful it can be for both your loved one and for you and your family. We also realize that it's never easy to send someone you care about into rehab, but it's easier when you partner with us. Let Addiction Recovery Helpline assist your adult loved one to break the chains of addiction by finding just the right treatment center to meet their needs. Call us today toll-free at 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844, the number 2, BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. It's too important to wait even one more day to make that call. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or on the web at getsobernow.net. Most insurance plans accepted.
And now, back to Gwen Cardin on Break the Chains.
Today we're talking with author and gymnast Joe Putignano about his fascinating biography, Acrobatic. Before the break, Joe, you were telling us about your early years when you began honing your gymnastic talents and also about some of the external factors that were becoming a perfect storm for you to ultimately become a drug abuser. So let's move into a little bit about how drugs entered your life and maybe what they did for you that made them feel like maybe they were okay for you.
Yes, it was very interesting because as I was talking about before, I did suffer from asthma, and very unusual for me because, you know, I was an athlete and I was trying to breathe, and I would go to the emergency room and they'd give me medicine and then I could breathe. And it was like this, you know, day and night. I was suffering on the inside. I couldn't breathe. Everything hurt. And then after the medicine, I was fine. And I was like, oh, my God, like, this is amazing. I love to talk about that because that kind of explains later on when I had my first drink, how I felt on an emotional, psychological level. I think I was like 15 or 16, and I, as I said earlier, I hated alcohol. I saw the damage it did throughout my entire family. And, you know, the other kids at school started to drink, and because my parents were at the restaurant, I had all the freedom. And we actually had a lot of booze in the house because we were getting free booze all the time, and they'd bring it home. So I had two of my friends over, and they would drink, and I would clean up after them. And it didn't seem, when they were doing it, it didn't seem bad. It just seemed like, you know, they would have a few drinks or a few beers and they were laughing. And I wanted to laugh too. And I wanted to be a part of this. But I knew it was going to affect my gymnastics because I had seen other kids on the gymnastics team who started drinking, their athletics decline. I love to talk about the pressure of athletics, because in a sport like gymnastics, you are judged for what you do. You get a score, everyone can see your scores, and this creates kind of a mindset of perfectionism. Because if you don't get, you know, back then it was a perfect 10, then that means there's something wrong. You did something wrong. And everyone can see this. That kind of perfectionism started to bleed into every facet of my life. And I was putting myself under a tremendous amount of pressure to be the best, to be perfect, because ultimately you get a better score, which means you've avoided shame. And which is an impossible feat. It's like nobody is perfect and nobody, yes, it's impossible. So basically you're setting yourself up for the hugest failure. But psychologically I did not know that. And I had my first drink and it was exactly like the asthma medication. It was the most beautiful moment at that point in my life, because that perfectionism melted. I didn't have to be the best. I didn't care what my parents were doing. My friends liked me more, and we had fun. Like, it was as if Joe didn't have to be the gymnast. He could just be human. And it was such a relief. Like, I still, when I hear other alcoholics describe this moment, their first drink, I can relate on such a level. It always gets me excited, because like, yes, I'm human. I'm here. We often say we've arrived. So I drank, and this became a solution. In the same way that when I couldn't breathe, I took my inhaler. So when things got too tough, I had a drink. And back then it was just fun. Like, we didn't, you know, high school kids experiment. I think there's nothing wrong with that. It's natural. We all did it. I started to do it a little bit more, though. I noticed I was the first person to pick up a beer and the last person to put it down. And I still had gymnastics class on the weekend. And it wasn't affecting that at first. So I kind of felt like I was getting away with something. I also didn't want to tell my parents or my brother, who was a huge drinker, who always wanted me to drink, because they knew how much I hated alcohol, and I didn't want them knowing I actually liked something they liked. You know, as a kid, I was against everything. Yes, I mean, we do that as children. We try to go against our parents, and I didn't want them to know that they were on to something. Like, I could actually appreciate something they were doing. However, this is very important. I believed, because my whole life I had seen how alcohol can spiral out of control, that I had the best knowledge to prevent alcoholic drinking, to prevent things from going bad, because I had seen it all. I mean, you don't get a better learning experience than that. You know, I grew up in a bar.
It isn't funny, but it is interesting, the irony of it.
Oh, completely. So I wasn't going to become an alcoholic. I knew exactly what not to do. All the alcoholic cliches we tell ourselves: don't drink in the morning, don't drink alone. I love that one. And this is very, my brother came to me once and he said, this is very young. He's like, you're not an alcoholic if you don't drink for 7 days, if you can go without drinking for 7 days. Like, so that, it's funny when we hear these misinformation, because we believe it. And that, and so when I heard that, I was like, oh, okay, so if I can go 7 days, then I don't have a problem. Of course, I mean, anyone can, not anyone, but most people can go 7 days at first, you know, before the addiction gets progressive. So I had all this misinformation around me, and I was definitely, because I saw how bad they were, I was keeping it at arm's length. I'm like, well, I'll never be as bad as them. I'll never be as bad as them. But what did happen is pot came into the mix. And again, you know, it wasn't saw my friends smoking pot. It wasn't like reefer madness. It wasn't like the way I was taught in health class. Like, you're going to smoke weed and you're going to jump out of a building.
Right.
So, yes, which I always get upset when I hear scare tactics like that, because that's not how it was. I like to be informed on actually how it is. And what happened was I laughed and food tasted better, and it seemed harmless. And it was that kind of harmless fun in the beginning. And then it made me look at, you know, the stuff they were teaching me in health class. And I said, well, this isn't how you guys were explaining it. I wonder if the other drugs are different then. I wonder if, you know, they're exaggerating about cocaine and acid and things like that. Although I was never going to try it. I mean, to me, the line was drawn in the sand. Like, you can drink on the weekends. You can smoke pot sometimes, but gymnastics comes first, because this is what saved you. Now, it's very important, because in my book, I know I talk about how I feel like drugs saved my life. And I know what a strange statement that is, but those who are addicted might agree. I was so depressed, from the perfectionism, from being an outsider, that they gave me hope to carry on. And I feel like without that kind of shift in consciousness, that kind of moments of euphoria, I may have tried to kill myself at that age.
As a teenager.
As a teenager, yes. It's interesting. I heard someone speak once, and they said if you drive through America, you see a lot of liquor stores and a lot of churches, because they both give people hope. Mm. And yes, and that's true. It's that maybe today isn't good, but you know, when I do this thing, I believe that I'm free. Tomorrow could be better. And that is exactly what it did for me. So in an odd way, I believe they did save my life at the time.
And you did move on to other drugs like ecstasy, and you started, at what point did it start escalating beyond, say, just on the weekends? When did it start getting to be a problem?
Well, I definitely started drinking alcoholically pretty quickly. All those rules I had, I stepped over. And it was that 90s rave era. And I went to my first rave. It was probably 1996. And I took my first ecstasy, and it was like heaven crashed into the earth. It changed my entire life. And a rave is very, very opposite of what you would expect from a gymnastics competition. So this was like, oh my God, this culture is amazing. And from that moment, drug seeking became the new gymnastics for me. Like, that became the top of the list. And it happened so fast for me, I cannot even express it. It was like one day this was what was important to me, and the next this was. So I chased that culture for a long time, and within that element, I started doing acid and K and crystal and ecstasy, all thinking it was recreational and safe, but it wasn't, because it started to affect my life very quickly. I was missing gymnastics class, and, you know, it was changing my behavior, because chemicals do change our perception and our behavior, and I started to get moody and fighting with my parents, and I was pierced from head to toe, which was a huge problem competing, because you get deductions for having body piercings, but I didn't care. You know, I was starting to get that almost antagonistic childhood rebellion, like, I'm going to change the world, and this is, you know, this is what I stand for now, not respecting anything around me, and really I was just kind of, I believed I was finding myself. So my mother, who was like, I don't know what's happening to you, you know, my response was, I'm finding myself, leave me alone. This mm-hmm. is important to me. And yeah, things really started to spiral out of control. And at that time, I was 16, 17, and I knew I wasn't going to the Olympics. I knew it. I missed my chance. There's a moment in every athlete's life where we accept reality. And I did go to nationals, but I knew it was over. And that opened the door. It was like, okay, now for the rest of my life, every day I will wake up a failure because I had one goal, one dream, and it's never going to happen. Mm-hmm. And what do you do? For me, I went on an extremely long road to destroy my life.
And we will talk about that in a minute because we need to take another break. But we'll be right back after these messages, and we'll be back with Joe Putignano hearing more about his fascinating life story. So don't go away.
Is there someone you love who is suffering from alcohol or drug addiction? Do you feel like you simply don't know where to turn? We at Addiction Recovery Helpline know how painful it can be for both your loved one and for you and your family. We also realize that it's never easy to send someone you care about into rehab, but it's easier when you partner with us. Let Addiction Recovery Helpline assist your adult loved one to break the chains of addiction by finding just the right treatment center to meet their needs. Call us today toll-free at 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. It's too important to wait even one more day to make that call. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or on the web at getsobernow.net. Most insurance plans accepted.
If you're an adult suffering from drug or alcohol addiction, why not make today the day that you break the chains? At New Life Addiction Treatment Center in Port St. Lucie, Florida, we know it's not easy to pick up the phone and make that call. But remember, the caring staff at New Life is here to help. Count on us to partner with you to guide you towards getting your life back. Our confidential residential program takes most insurance plans and is designed to help meet your unique needs. Write this number down and give New Life Addiction Treatment Center a call right now. The toll-free number is 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. Your life is waiting for you, and so are we. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or getsobernow.net.
Welcome back to Break the Chains. Here again, your host, Gwen Cardin.
Before we resume our talk with Joe, I'd like to remind you that I really do appreciate receiving feedback and ideas from listeners, and I would especially like to hear from you. So please take a couple of minutes after the show to email me your ideas and comments at addictionradioshow@gmail.com. We're talking today to author Joe Putignano, and Joe is sharing his amazing story of tragedy and triumph over drug addiction as told in his new book, Acrobatic. Joe, before the break, you were describing how you began drinking alcohol and you experimented with some drugs at raves. And at one point in your life, though, your drug taking got really serious. And in part, you mentioned before having to do with the fact that you realized you weren't going to the Olympics. It had been your only dream and you were kind of a lost soul. So let's talk a little bit about when life and the drug addiction got really tough.
For me, it got tough quickly. I did go to college and I competed on the men's gymnastics team. And I really only went to college because it was a place to live. I did not want to get an education, and I just wanted to get out of my mother's house because two addicts can't really live under the same roof peacefully. And I met a cocaine dealer and eventually started doing lots of coke. It's funny how as addicts we always find them. And it really got bad very quickly. It was the kind of addiction where I didn't want to get out of bed without it. It's kind of the same way I am with coffee now. Yes, and it's interesting because I didn't have any energy unless I had Coke, and I was only a freshman. But by the time of my, I was going back and forth to Boston, and all these raid kids, we started taking benzos. It was very big where I was from. We were taking Klonopin, Valium, and Xanax, lots of them, which make you very tired. So of course you need more Coke. So that was my introduction to benzos, and I loved them because they make you feel calm and peaceful and everything's okay, which was really what was missing from my life. And my cocaine use got really bad, and I started to talk to a counselor at the college because I realized I wasn't going to any classes. I had all F's, and the gymnastics team, which I was getting grants for, they were starting to get really worried about me. I mean, everybody knew my use. It was pretty public. So
you were on the gymnastics team at your college and using all these drugs pretty regularly.
Yes. Oh, yes. Very regularly. And I was missing practice. And it's just, you know, you're living on campus, so everybody knows each other's lifestyle. It's a small private college. And she asked if I wanted to go to rehab so that I could try it out. And, like, well, yeah, you know, this has been ongoing for a long time. Yes, I would like to try it. And that was my first attempt at any sort of recovery. What I found out in the rehab is that I really didn't have a problem because I wasn't ready to put the drugs down. And it was very interesting because I remember I left against medical advice on the fourth day, and the counselor told me, you will be back here someday as a heroin addict. And I was like, oh, my God, what? It's the worst thing you could ever say to somebody. But I left on the fourth day, and the college did not like this, so they kicked me out and said, you have to finish treatment if we're going to allow you back in. So I went to another treatment, and I found a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist ended up putting me on tons of medication. And I knew what I was doing at this point. I became very manipulative. And I was basically guiding her into giving me benzos. And I succeeded. I knew exactly what I was doing, and she started giving me Klonopins. And now I know I'm an addict, and I'm getting a prescription for these with a refill. And I manipulated this woman down to getting the highest milligram, free from the state. And I was taking, oh, my gosh, I was taking about 10 as soon as I would wake up, getting more from people from Boston. And I started to have seizures without the medication. I was blacking out all the time. And I was on campus, so this was public. I mean, I was getting in trouble. There was cops, So eventually I got kicked out of college, lost my scholarship grant and everything, and I couldn't go back home. Every time I had gone back home during the college breaks, my mom would call the cops on me because I became violent. I mean, this was a dramatic jump from where I was. And I was homeless, and I had to sleep in outside in the park near the school. I also would stay at drug dealers' couches and I always stayed too long. You know, I could tell everyone was like, okay, it's time for you to go. And I lost all my friends at that time because my behavior was so unpredictable. And during that time, I traveled the country. I kept getting more and more pills. I kept calling the psychiatrist and telling her all the addictive things. People stole them, you know, this and this and this. And then something terrible happened where, so I'd been doing this for about a year and a half. My parents didn't know if I was alive anymore. I would call collect. I was in homeless shelters. Everything to make it work because it was still a solution. And then one time I ended up back at home in Boston and I did my usual, had all my pills, and I saw a doctor because I wanted more, and he gave me painkillers. And that night I took all my pills, I took the painkillers, and I was told, and this is in the book, that somebody found me and they dropped me off at home, and my mom found me and I was foaming at the mouth, and apparently my heart stopped, and so they had to resuscitate me and put me in the ambulance, and I woke up in another rehab. This had been my fourth rehab, but the doctor told me that, you know, my heart stopped twice and I had a cardiac death, but this still wasn't enough to make me stop. It kind of made me feel like I had beat death, you know, like I was unstoppable. Mm-hmm. The kind of feeling all of us had in our 20s. And this went on for so long, and my entire life fell apart. Like, I wanted to die, but I was afraid to die. So addiction is that place between life and death.
So when did heroin come into your life?
Heroin didn't come until a little bit later. I actually learned if every time I took a pill, something bad was going to happen. So I was like, I have to stop taking these pills. And I was trying to get clean. Like, I was making attempts. I was going to 12-step meetings. And when I moved to New York City, and I got a job as a waiter, and I noticed he had a peculiar behavior. So I was like, ah, that's painkiller behavior. I know it. He's itchy, and he's nodding out. And I was right. He had heroin, and I had been warned so many times from people not to do heroin, but warnings mean nothing to a person like me. And I started sniffing heroin recreationally, and I know that's an oxymoron because there's no such thing as recreational heroin. Yeah, we'd like to think it, but it was very textbook. For 2 years, I sniffed it, and on the second year, I started shooting it. And that drug, and I know this is important now because heroin is really on the rise again, which is kind of shocking to me. But it did everything for me that I ever wanted. Like, the pain I felt inside, the depression, the anxiety, the regret, it was gone. I felt loved. I felt like God was holding me. So I was never, ever, ever going to live a life without it. I didn't want a life. I didn't want a job. I didn't want love because I had heroin. Like, why do I need anything else?
So did you lose jobs? Did you lose friends? Did you lose places to live? Was your health going downhill?
Yes. I mean, every horrible addict thing you can think of happened. I lost friends from heroin. It's weird. It's not a party drug, you know? So it wasn't like the 70s that I hear about. I wasn't there, but, you know, where there was 10 people shooting dope in a room. It was very lonely. It was either me and one other person or just me. But I really did look. I was skinny. I had track marks. And I managed to keep jobs. I got very lucky in life where people would see the innocence in me. I look very young for my age. I always have. And I do look like the boy from, you know, next door. That's very honest. And I used this. This was a huge manipulation for me because people were like, Joe, no, he's not an addict. Look at him. And I was very kind. So I managed to keep jobs, but I definitely had to manipulate. Eventually I started working at the New York Times, which is incredible. I know, incredible because of someone like me, basically. And again, I did have some moments of intelligence. I had some moments of being normal. Like, I always like to tell people, addicts don't commit to a lifestyle of crime, you know, on purpose. Like, we are always trying to better ourselves. I was trying, you know, I would have moments where I'm like, okay, get it together. Like, yes, you're going to use 4 times a day. You're going to take your medicine, but you can't look high. You have to go to work. You're going to achieve something. you can fix this.
I'm going to have to interrupt here, but you very quickly though, you ended up getting, I mean, despite all this and what you were doing to your body, you ended up being in a show at the Metropolitan Opera on Broadway, and this whole time you're still shooting up. Is that right?
Yes. That was, extremely difficult. But I believe all my training in gymnastics, sort of guided me on this unusual path, because I was so good at using the body, like mechanics. It was like second nature that no matter how high I was able to go out there on stage and, perform, and nobody knew. And I was able to handle the withdrawal. Because it was just like doing gymnastics, like that injury, that sickness, that kind of really difficult athletic pain. It just seemed so familiar. So it was like, wow, this is just another level of gymnastics. And it was very sad because I didn't even know as a gymnast you could perform. And I left the New York Times because they actually sent me to rehab, which was wonderful. I got a little bit of sobriety, and I started doing gymnastics and becoming a performer, and I did end up on Broadway. I had 2 years clean, and this Broadway job was righting that wrong, that regret, that Olympic failure. It was kind of second best. Mm-hmm. And the show was closing. It was a Bob Dylan show, and I was sad. I didn't know how to have coping skills, and I remember shooting up in the Broadway bathroom theater to knock it on heaven's door, which was singing on the yes, which is
kind of ironic.
Every once in a while our life is perfect synchronicity to the music around us, and that was that moment where it was like, wow.
It's that time again. We're gonna have to take a quick break from the show, but stay tuned and we'll be right back.
If you're an adult suffering from drug or alcohol addiction, why not make today the day that you break the chains? At New Life Addiction Treatment Center in Port St. Lucie, Florida, we know it's not easy to pick up the phone and make that call. But remember, the caring staff at New Life is here to help. Count on us to partner with you to guide you towards getting your life back. Our confidential residential program takes most insurance plans and is designed to help meet your unique needs. Write this number down and give New Life Addiction Treatment Center a call right now. The toll-free number is 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. Your life is waiting for you, and so are we. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or getsobernow.net.
Is there someone you love who is suffering from alcohol or drug addiction? Do you feel like you simply don't know where to turn? We at Addiction Recovery Helpline know how painful it can be for both your loved one and for you and your family. We also realize that it's never easy to send someone you care about into rehab, but it's easier when you partner with us. Let Addiction Recovery Helpline assist your adult loved one to break the chains of addiction by finding just the right treatment center to meet their needs. Call us today toll-free at 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. It's too important to wait even one more day to make that call. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or on the web at getsobernow.net. Most insurance plans accepted.
You're listening to Break the Chains, America's top radio source of information for people struggling with drug or alcohol addiction. Here's your host, Gwen Cardin.
Before we resume talking to author and gymnast Joe Putignano about his descent into drug addiction, I want to invite you to go to our Facebook page and like us. You can find it at www.facebook.com/breakthechains1. When we broke a few minutes ago, Joe was talking about the day or the night that he was shooting up in the bathroom of a Broadway theater after he had learned that the show was closing. Obviously, since Joe's written a book, he's talking to me today. He's gotten clean. His life is a whole lot better. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, he was actually a featured performer in Cirque du Soleil. So, Joe, would you take a few minutes to tell us how you turned your life around and a little bit about what life is like for you today?
Yes, that time I did get high at the Broadway job, it lasted about a week, and that was the last time I used. I had 2 years clean before that, so I knew what sobriety was like. I just didn't have really good coping skills, and the obsession never left me. I was going to 12-step meetings every day, and everyone was telling me that the obsession will leave you, but it hadn't. So when I did relapse, I realized something important, that I actually liked being sober better because, I felt better because heroin made me sick all the time. And B, I started to get things back in my life that I really admired and appreciated. So I went back to 12-step meetings, and I did what so many people who relapsed have to do. It's courageous. So if you're out there still struggling, I completely understand. And I said I had one day clean. And I got back on the horse and worked so hard at staying clean. I made it my focus. I went to meetings. I did my step work. And life did get better again. Not wonderful, but better. And I continued to perform. It was really incredible because I got to work with Cirque du Soleil. And as you were saying, I was the Crystal Man, which... it was a character I got to develop with director Robert LaPage, and it was really wonderful because the show is about evolution, but we did tie my sobriety into it as this spark of light, this change that comes down as spiritual evolution. So every night I got to wear this costume of 5,000 glass mirrors, and I got to think of my sobriety and to offer that kind of hope that those of us in recovery or those of us that know have been touched by addicts or changed by them try to inspire others to never give up, to keep going, because that is really what my character embodied. So it was really wonderful, and I did that show for 3.5 years, and unfortunately I did get injured pretty badly, which I had 2 shoulder surgeries on. And coming up actually soon on CNN with Dr. Sanjay Gupta, we are doing a story on sobriety and surgery because I'm a heroin addict and I can't take painkillers. I know many people in recovery can, and they do take them and they're okay. But for someone like me, if you read my book, you'll see if I have one opiate, that obsession that I spoke about before, it does return for me and I'm powerless. And the obsession for myself is gone. And it's been very interesting. I did write my book, Acrobatics, while I was on tour with Cirque du Soleil, and have been able to talk about heroin addiction and recovery. I've been very lucky with it because I got to do Anderson Cooper and Dr. Sanjay and a lot of really extraordinary things to kind of give that message out to recovering addicts, you know, that it's possible, because I know when you're in that addiction, it feels hopeless, absolutely hopeless. So my message is seriously, don't give up. And no matter how many times you fail, keep trying. Yeah.
Because you you tried and failed and tried and failed and tried and failed. I mean, this went on. Well, the heroin addiction was how many years?
Oof, about 10 years. Yeah, give or take.
So yeah. You made a lot of attempts, and the fact that you continued trying, you know, says something about your will to live. But I also find it interesting, and you just mentioned it a minute ago, about the obsession does get better. And I think that if you could elaborate just a little bit on that for people, because that I would think would give people hope that I'm not always going to feel this compelled.
Yes, it's very interesting. If you're in active addiction, it is very much like there is a demon inside of you, which I do describe in my book. It's like you're being possessed. And you cannot see any other way out because it's inside of you. But over time, your brain mechanics will rewire themselves. You'll have different pleasure, but that takes time in order to do that. So the, it's like muscle memory. So it's just, it's really science. Over time, you will forget what that felt like, and the obsession will get lifted. Unfortunately, it does take a long time, but it does happen. So you have to allow it. And just imagine what your life is free, or what will feel like when you're free from that demon. It's definitely extraordinary. And it doesn't mean that life is going to be roses. Life is always going to be life. But you are free from that obsession, which is really astounding.
And I think also you mentioned a few minutes ago about that pretty bad shoulder injury. Is your career in gymnastics over because of that? And if so, what's ahead for you?
Sadly, we just found out last week from the surgeons it is over. I won't be able to go back to athletics like I was. And, you know, as I just said, life isn't always roses. We have to deal with upsets and stuff. So I'm going to go back to school to be a PA. I'm trying to, physician's assistant. And I still am going to try and perform, just not acrobatically. And I am writing a second book, which is not recovery related, but it is more of a fiction. So things still happen, you know. Life will still go on, and I know many people who are performers who do get injured that can't go on. And it is heartbreaking for me on a sober aspect, because gymnastics is kind of what saved me in a way. Mm-hmm. But I have enough recovery now that if it's taken away from me, I have enough tools that I will be able to stay sober without it.
Okay, Joe, we're coming to the end of our show. Can you tell listeners quickly how they can get a copy of your book, Acrobatic?
Sure. Yes, you can get it on Amazon through ebook or Kindle or hard copy. You can get it at Barnes & Noble. And I believe any local bookstore should have it in the addiction section if you just Google it online or even go in and ask for it.
Okay, people are going to find out when they read your book what an amazing writer you are, too, and I know you wrote that book yourself. Well, listen, be sure to tune in to Break the Chains next week at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, when I'll be talking to Sandy Swenson. Sandy is author of the forthcoming book, The Joey Song, and in her book she tells a heart-wrenching story of being the mother of a drug-addicted child and finally coming to a place of peace and acceptance over what she couldn't control, and you're not going to want to miss that. So for now, this is your host, Gwen Carden. Be safe, live smart, and most of all, take good care of yourself.